Before we get to the show, we're a few weeks into the Newsmatch campaign, and we need your help. As a listener of the world, you know the value of our journalism. Now is the time to step up and support it. Make a donation today at theworld.org/match to double your impact. That's theworld.org/match. Thank you. A strongman and a comedian sit down to negotiate. But the war between Vladimir Putin's Russia and Volodymyr Zelensky's Ukraine is no joke. We've got the latest on the start of peace talks. Plus, Aung San Suu Kyi was hailed as a defender of human rights. Now, she's defending Myanmar's brutality.
I have said that I condemn human rights everywhere. And you must not forget that there have been human rights violations on both sides of the communal divide.
But some of those violations look like genocide. And in Finland, 34-year-old Sanna Marin becomes prime minister.
This very special moment to have this female, all-women face of the government.
Also, the national election in the UK, some say it's a choice between unlikable and untrustworthy. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad you could make it here this Monday. Now it's Zelensky's turn. Since 2014, war in eastern Ukraine has killed more than 13,000 people. White House pressure on Vladimir Putin's ambitions in Ukraine seems to have been fruitless. So today, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky sat down himself with Putin in Paris to find a way out of the conflict. No one expects a quick resolution from these talks today. It is a big test for Zelensky in his first ever meeting with Putin. Back home, Ukrainians are watching carefully. Protesters in Ukraine's capital this week were chanting freedom to Ukraine. They are critics of President Zelensky, and so is Volodymyr Areyev. I caught up with him today while he was visiting Tbilisi, Georgia. Areyev is a member of the Ukrainian opposition party in parliament. He says Zelensky is not prepared for these talks.
For Mr. Putin, this time is best to have negotiations, as well as the United States is very focused on its own turmoil caused by Mr. Zelensky. And without this support, it looks like we are alone. The best result of that negotiations in Paris tonight is no result.
Why would no result in Paris be a good thing?
We cannot trust any agreements with the Russian Federation. So this point should be basic for Mr. Zelensky. Never trust Putin and don't count on possible agreements that might be signed after the Normandy format meeting, might be signed well or not.
Let me ask you this. So Ukraine doesn't feel the support from the U.S. right now. What does that mean for President Zelensky's reputation at home?
I think now it's a matter not of Zelensky's personal reputation, but it's a reputation for Ukraine. And the situation what we are faced to in the United States, well, you know, I can compare it to the very popular in the United States Super Bowl games. Now it looks like these Republican and Democrat teams and the ball is Ukraine. And during the game, no one cares about the ball. To be an object of interior American policy is not brings a good consequences for that object.
Well, I was really not expecting an American football analogy, but thanks for that anyway. I mean, there are concerns about capitulation in these talks in Ukraine, but isn't President Zelensky right? Don't you need to have some sort of dialogue with Russia to at least start to end this war?
To have a dialogue with Russia means that Russia should be ready to end this war. They could pretend that they're making a step forward to the peace, but at the same time, getting the result, Russia will come back to its usual style of conduct, and aggression will be ongoing. So the only one thing needed for a while is to keep on sanctions until Russian Federation will be ready for real peace, but not for imitation.
Who's singing in the background?
I'm sorry for that, but
no, that's okay.
I cannot avoid it. It's a Georgia.
Mr. Areyev, one more thing. I want to ask you about the Ukrainian public, because Volodymyr Zelensky won by a landslide last spring in the Ukrainian presidential elections. And surely with the war in the Donbas in the background, Ukrainians must have believed that Zelensky had some skills or strategy for dealing with Putin. Why did they vote for him if they didn't think he could be a peacemaker?
He promised to be a peacemaker. It's a completely different stories we are dealing with such a player like Russian Federation. So Ukrainians, unfortunately, made its choice by emotions. It was not so rational choice. You can find on Netflix a TV series, Servant of the People.
That was Zelensky's old show.
And people somehow trust the hero of the TV series, where Zelensky plays as a president of Ukraine. So there were implications of people's hopes. They extrapolate their wishes for his personality, then choose the people with a real program and the real background.
Volodymyr Areyev is a member of the Ukrainian parliament. His political party, European Solidarity, is part of the opposition to President Volodymyr Zelensky. Thank you very much for your time, Mr. Areyev.
Thank you.
More on Ukraine and the fight against corruption there later this hour here on The World. In the UK, it's untrustworthy versus unlikable. According to much of the British public, that's the grim political reality staring them in the face. On Thursday, the UK will hold its third national election in 4 years. And depending on where they live, voters have a choice between one of several different political parties. But let's face it, this is really a contest between just two key political figures, Boris Johnson, the current prime minister leading the Conservatives, and Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the main opposition party, Labour. The World's Orla Barry reports from London.
There was a time, not so long ago, when both of these British politicians were actually quite popular with voters. As Mayor of London, Boris Johnson basked in the goodwill that the Olympic Games brought to the city in 2012.
The excitement is growing so much, I think the Geiger counter of Olympomania is going to go zoink off the scale. Are we ready?
And for his part, Jeremy Corbyn seemed to reach rock star status when he stepped on stage at the Glastonbury Music Festival in 2017.
And if you can see that far, look on the wall right over there that surrounds this wonderful festival. And there's a message on that wall for President Donald Trump. And you know what it says? Build bridges, not walls.
But oh, how times have changed. When this election was called in October, the approval ratings for both Corbyn and Johnson had plummeted. In one poll, just 39% of British voters said they approved of Boris Johnson, now the country's prime minister, and only 20% said they thought Corbyn was doing a good job as the leader of the opposition Labour Party. So what went wrong? Well, politics is complicated in Britain, of course, but a big part of the answer, for Jeremy Corbyn at least, lies with Brexit. Tim Bale is politics professor at Queen Mary University of London.
His desire to sit on the fence on that particular question and not, if you like, plump very strongly either for Remain or for Leave has increased the public's perception that this is a man who can't make up his mind and so is indecisive.
Corbyn's indecisiveness has infuriated many Labour supporters, a majority of whom wanted Britain to stay in the European Union. But Brexit isn't his only problem. Allegations of anti-Semitism have dogged Corbyn's leadership. Even some of his fellow Labour Party members have accused him of not tackling the problem within the party's own ranks.
I cannot remain in a party that I have today come to the sickening conclusion is institutionally anti-Semitic.
Luciana Berger is a former Labour MP. Berger, who's Jewish, was one of seven parliamentary members who quit the Labour Party earlier this year. For her, anti-Semitism was a driving factor.
The leadership has willfully and repeatedly failed to address hatred against Jewish people within its ranks.
In the past week, 70 sworn statements from Labour officials detailing anti-Semitism within the party were leaked to the news media. And Corbyn, once again, found himself apologising.
Obviously, I'm very sorry for everything that's happened, but I want to make this clear. I am dealing with it. I have dealt with it. We just do not accept it in any form whatsoever.
But Corbyn's not the only one apologising for offending members of a minority community.
I've already said sorry for any offence that I've caused and I say it again.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson was forced to apologise on television this past week for comments he made about Muslim women. In a newspaper article last year, Johnson wrote that women who wear the burqa look like letterboxes and bank robbers.
I think what people want to know is, what are we going to do now?
Yeah, no, what people want to know, if you're going to be Prime Minister, why would you say something like that?
Well, I think, it's always worth looking at what the whole article says and what I'm really intending to say, because actually it's quite the opposite. And, I'm very proud of my record on combating extremism and indeed of my Muslim ancestry.
Indeed, as Johnson likes to mention in interviews, his great-grandfather was from Turkey. But it's not just Muslim women who've expressed anger towards Johnson. According to opinion polls, this Prime Minister is simply less popular with women in general. Some of this could have something to do with stories around his personal life. That came up in another recent interview.
How many children do you have?
Look, I love my children very much, but they are not standing at this election.
No.
And I'm not, therefore, going to comment on
them. Are you fully and wholly involved in all their lives?
Politics professor Tim Bale says Johnson's past hurts the public's trust in him as a national leader.
We know that he has, let's say, a fairly colourful past. But I think this is also a man, because he was a journalist, has said all sorts of things and done all sorts of things that he's had to go back on in later life. And therefore, that gives the impression of someone who says one thing and does another, or promises something and then goes back on it.
Today, the leader of the DUP, the Northern Irish party that supported the Conservatives in government, said she felt betrayed by Boris Johnson over his Brexit deal. But just how much do personalities matter in British general elections? Because voters will be choosing a party, not an individual, when they go to vote on Thursday. Here's Professor Tim Bale again.
In the UK, we don't live in a presidential system. We live in a parliamentary system. So therefore, people aren't voting for the leader directly as they are in, for example, the United States of America. However, we do know that over the years, leaders have become more important to people's vote choices. So Boris Johnson is seen as a bit of a lovable rogue by the British. And Jeremy Corbyn, I think, is seen as rather kind of tetchy, slightly kind of obsessive, and not the kind of person that you want to go and have a drink with.
And for many voters, that's how they're seeing their two big choices. Will it be roguish Johnson or tetchy Corbyn? For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
White Island is a tourist destination 30 miles off the east coast of New Zealand. And today at 2 p.m. local time, it erupted.
Today was really noticeable because of just a wonderful blue sky and suddenly a huge plume of steam right in the middle of our bay.
That's boat skipper Phil van de Schotten. As the ash and steam spewed from the volcano, tourists on another boat were ordered below deck.
Blindside. Unfortunately, I can confirm there are five people now deceased from the eruption on White Island.
New Zealand's Deputy Police Commissioner John Timm spoke earlier today.
A number of other people have been taken to Whakatane Hospital and Middlemore Hospital.
He said they now believe that everyone who survived the explosion has been taken off the island. There's no sign of life on the island, he said. Before the eruption, a photo showed people walking in the crater of the volcano. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said a number of tourists had been on the island.
I know there will be a huge amount of concern and anxiety for those who have loved ones on or around the island at the time. And I can assure them police are doing everything they can.
White Island is also known as Whakaari. It means the dramatic volcano. It is New Zealand's most active volcanic island. It's uninhabited.
It's a spectacular place. It's beautiful. It's kind of a feeling of raw energy. And you can hear the volcano roaring.
Ben Kennedy is a volcanologist who's been researching White Island for the past 10 years. Here's how he describes what likely happened today. Beneath the ground is a layer of magma.
So magma is molten rock, so the red glowing stuff under the ground.
Magma releases gas. It rises to the surface.
And if the pipe that connects the magma to the surface is a nice open pipe, then this gas happily bubbles out of the top of the volcano and produces a beautiful sight for tourists to observe. However, if gas periodically gets blocked on its journey towards the surface, this can build up pressure, and this pressure will need to be released. And when it's released, it can do a throat-clearing event and cause a hazard.
One that may spew out rock and ash, and in this case, send smoke miles into the sky. That's not that large as far as volcanic eruptions go. But if you are close, it is not good. Kennedy says this eruption is not totally surprising. The island had recently been on heightened alert. You're with The World. As a listener of The World, you know that our journalists bring new perspectives and insights to issues like climate change. Just this year, reporter Carolyn Beeler spent 2 months on an expedition to Antarctica studying the effects of climate change and reporting for The World. Shirin Jafari took us inside Saudi Arabia to report on the changing role of women there and barriers to those changes. Producer Daniel Offman and I traveled to Russia to meet young people who love Vladimir Putin and others who organize in opposition to him. Not every newsroom would invest in this kind of reporting, but we do. If you value in-depth, on-the-ground journalism that brings you right into the story, then step up and support it today. A gift of any size makes a difference, but if you donate $60 today, that will be doubled to $120. Just visit theworld.org/match. Thanks very much. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Russia is now banned from competing in international sporting events for the next 4 years, and that includes the Olympics. Today's announcement comes from WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency. It's a partial ban, actually. Russia is prevented from hosting international events and sending officials to competitions, but there's also a pathway for Russian athletes to compete in the 2020 Olympics under a neutral flag if they can prove they're clean. Rob Keeler is a former head of WADA. He's now general director of Global Athlete. That's a group that advocates for athletes' rights. Keeler is one of many critics who say that the ban on Russia does not go far enough.
Russia has undermined the anti-doping system over the last 7 years. Before I resigned in August 2018, I had full oversight of the Russian roadmap. I stuck to my guns day after day, indicating that we would not let Russian officials and athletes back at international events until they admitted they were involved in institutionalized doping. But in September 2018, WADA gave in and let Russia back based on promises of providing data. They didn't provide the data. In fact, they manipulated the data. And to see a meaningful cultural change in Russia, there has to be a price to pay. And unfortunately, the athletes will have to suffer. But that's something that needs to be done. They haven't learned their lesson yet. And until there's a strong sanction, they won't learn their lesson.
So the ban essentially says that Russian athletes can't go under the Russian flag to the World Cup and the Olympics. But they can compete. Is that the deal?
That's right. They can compete. This is a game being played, in my opinion. Leading up to Pyeongchang in December 2017, the IOC announced that they were going to ban Russia. And then in January, they made a new statement saying they're going to ban Russia, but they can compete as Olympic athletes of Russia. Yet again, they seem to bend the rules for Russia because they are a powerful sport nation. They wield a lot of influence, and the international community continues to let them compete. This was the biggest hit to integrity of sport of this century, if not ever. And if the World Agency doesn't uphold the strongest sanction, they're letting athletes down globally.
You've got a feel, though, for the Russian athletes who are not guilty. I mean, do you really think somebody like Russian runner Yulia Stepanova, who exposed doping fraud with her husband, should be banned from competition?
The reality is, there's 145 athletes that will never know if they've doped or not because they've manipulated the data of those athletes. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I'm looking at the future generation of Russian athletes that should have the ability to compete in sport and the ability to compete clean. And the reason I say that is Russian athletes that we've spoken to don't have a choice to compete clean. If they're in the system and they're asked to do something, they either do it or they have to leave. So how can you be sure anyone's clean? It's a tough call to ban all Russian athletes. It's harsh, but it's not the first time. And that's the other thing people don't realize. The International Olympic Committee banned South African athletes for almost 20 years because of apartheid. So it's been done in the past, and we cannot hold athletes to a different standard.
So you clearly don't think, Rob, that today's punishment is going to make Russia change its behavior. What do you think will happen 4 years from now once this ban is complete?
Well, I don't think it will change the culture. And if I have a crystal ball, I suspect that the Russians will appeal this decision to the Court of Arbitration of Sport. They have 21 days where they can appeal this decision. And then the Court of Arbitration, which is not independent either because they are fully funded by the International Olympic Committee, has a choice to make. They can either increase the sanction or they can overrule WADA's decision. And I think it's going to be something to watch. My fear is that everything will be forgotten. In all likelihood, the Russians could win this appeal.
Rob Keeler, formerly with the World Anti-Doping Agency, he's now Director General of Global Athlete. That's a group that advocates for global athletes' rights. Rob, thanks for your time.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, you know this song.
Go
In Finland, at least, that's not an overstatement. The country's transport minister, Sanna Marin, is about to become the youngest sitting prime minister anywhere. She's 34. Marin will lead a center-left coalition that includes four other parties, all headed by women. Three of those women also under the age of 35. The group is being hailed as a new generation in Finnish politics. Johanna Kantola is professor of gender studies at Tampere University in Finland.
They are quite strongly, for example, for equality. They are happy to call themselves feminists. It's not a very happy term in Finnish to call oneself feminist. It's also a pejorative term, like in many other countries. So it's quite special that they don't shy away from this term. They're also very green. So most of them really want to fight climate change, and they're happy to talk about it. So there is a specific outlook and a stark contrast to the government that came before this government. But it's a very kind of a very special moment for Finnish politics, for gender and politics in Finland, to have this female, all-women face of the government.
And what is the opposition that this young group of women politicians is facing in Finland?
The government that came before these parliamentary elections, which we had in May, this was a very conservative government, which had the radical right populist party in it. So we are one of the European countries which has had the right populists in the government. And something that affected all women was the fact that the government took away the statutory right to public childcare in public kindergartens. And this has been the backbone of the Finnish women-friendly welfare state and has really enabled women's labour market participation. So it was quite radical that the government decided to take away this right. And now this current government, the Social Democratic government, is bringing this right back.
Yeah, I can imagine how that move alone would have been hugely symbolic for women all over Finland in terms of what a right-wing government could possibly do to their lives.
Yes, absolutely. One of the wake-up calls.
Let me get back to something you said a moment ago, the word feminist, that it's kind of seen as pejorative in Finland, and yet this young generation, this new generation of politicians, they kind of embrace the word feminism. What is the context for why that's a bad word in Finland?
So in Finland, there is this distinction between the bad feminists and the people who kind of support gender equality but are not too radical feminists. So we have very traditional ideas about feminists, and it's constructed as this straw person to fight against. So that's why it matters and why it's encouraging that there is this new generation for whom it's not a problem.
And do you think those attitudes are going to change just because Finland's about to get a 34-year-old and its third female prime minister?
We'll certainly be observing that and studying that. Gender still matters in Finnish politics. It's not completely equal. We haven't reached equality. Women and men politicians are portrayed differently by the media. There's a lot more attention to women's appearance, what they wear, how their makeup is, whether they have young children. These are all signs of the continuing inequalities. So it would be interesting to see whether these perceptions and ways of talking about women in politics will change.
Johanna Kantola is a professor of gender studies at Tampere University in Finland. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're with the world.
What do Goldman Sachs experts and leading thinkers have to say about trending shaping markets, industries, and the global economy? And what macroeconomic issues are on the minds of our clients? Listen to Goldman Sachs podcasts to find out. Available at www.gs.com/podcasts. Or any of your favorite podcast platforms.
Impeachment hearings resume today. Coming up, we have the latest, plus how Ukrainians are fighting the good fight against corruption.
It's using the state resources in one's personal favor. It's stealing. It's the abuse of power. And that doesn't matter whose style of corruption that is.
Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. The Pentagon is winning the war in Afghanistan. At least that's what U.S. policymakers have been telling Americans since 2001. But that assessment is full of spin, according to a new trove of documents, a cache of previously unpublished interviews with top U.S. policymakers, along with memos long held in secret that describe the war's failure, were just published by The Washington Post. Ambassador Douglas Lute is a retired three-star Army general who served as the White House's top advisor on Afghanistan from 2007 to 2013.
These documents that have now been made public were internal U.S. government documents intended to shine a bright light on the experience in Afghanistan and to learn from that experience. The government was actually taking, and has been taking, a very hard look at itself and look at itself in the mirror and see what we can learn.
So you told government interviewers, Ambassador, in 2015 that those devising the Afghan strategy were, quote, devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan and didn't have the foggiest notion of what we were undertaking, end quote. I mean, that's a pretty serious indictment. How did you come to that conclusion, and what were you saying publicly at the time?
I think the important thing here is context. So this was an internal government attempt to gather candidly, by way of interviews, lessons from folks who had been involved with policy making in Afghanistan over a period of years. So this was never intended to be a headline-making effort.
Why didn't we know about this at the time? Everybody was saying everything was going fine, and apparently it was not.
Well,
far from it.
Yeah, no. So I dispute that a bit. I'm not sure. I don't think the record is absolute that everyone said everything was going fine. I mean, I think those who are carefully watching Afghanistan for a long time now have been much more cautious in terms of their optimism and have been much more balanced in terms of the challenges faced there. I mean, look, things like the poverty level, the corruption level in Afghanistan, the continuing challenges of the Taliban with safe haven in Pakistan, these are not brand new topics to the American public. So for those who've been watching this carefully, I think it's a much more balanced picture in terms of the challenges faced in Afghanistan.
And perhaps for the people watching it carefully, but in terms of relaying what was really happening on the ground to the U.S. taxpaying public, I mean, it was delivered in very Pollyannish terms, and that's not what we read in this report, what was actually happening.
I'm not completely aligned with your view. I mean, look, when we went to Afghanistan, it was the fourth poorest country in the world. The corruption level was endemic, the long-standing problems with opium production, and so forth. So I think these sorts of notes of caution have nearly always accompanied the indications, the suggestions that we could make progress.
And yet, I mean, we're seeing stories about Defense Secretary Rumsfeld saying, essentially, we don't know who the enemy is in Afghanistan. I mean, that's more than just, well, some things were bad and some things were good. I mean, that's an admission of serious wrongdoing, frankly.
Well, I'm not going to lay the blame for wrongdoing and so forth by way of this interview. But look, anyone who was involved in Afghanistan over the last now 18 years has to come away with a sense that this is going to be tremendously hard. And I think that the reports that have now been made public certainly reveal that.
Why is this report valuable?
Well, I think it's valuable in a number of ways. One of the reasons that this balance between optimism and skepticism has been perhaps skewed over the years is that we did not establish what I would refer to as continuity in the effort in Afghanistan. We had a revolving door of senior military leaders, policy leaders in Washington, ambassadors on the ground in Afghanistan and Pakistan, all of which served dutifully and served honorably during their periods. But frankly, we didn't establish enough continuity among them so that they could get a deep, textured understanding of what was going on in Afghanistan. So when I made the comment we didn't know what we were doing, I mean that when you sum up over time, we didn't develop enough government expertise over these years to actually come up with a sufficient strategy.
Ambassador Douglas Lute is a three-star Army general who served as the White House's top advisor on Afghanistan under Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Congress took another step closer to impeaching President Donald Trump today. At times, the proceedings were, let's just say, lively.
We will now hear presentations.
Chairman, I appeal the decision of the chair.
There's no decision to appeal. There was not a ruling and a motion. We will now hear presentations.
There's a ruling on the point of order.
You made a ruling on the point of order.
You made a ruling on the point of order, Mr. Chairman. You can't then not allow us to appeal the ruling of the chair.
The gentleman will suspend.
That's Jerry Nadler, the Democratic chair of the House Judiciary Committee, trying to keep the hearing on track as Republican members tried repeatedly to disrupt things. President Trump has been accused of abuse of office and obstruction of justice in pursuit of personal political goals. Nadler opened the hearing today with this argument.
This pattern of conduct represents a continuing risk to the country. The evidence shows that Donald J. Trump, the President of the United States, has put himself before his country. He has violated his most basic responsibilities to the people. He has broken his oath.
The Republicans, of course, have a very different view. Here's the ranking member, Doug Collins, from Georgia.
There have been famous moments in impeachment as we've gone forward. There are famous lines from Nixon, like, what did the president know and when did he know it? From the Clinton impeachment, there was, I did not have sex with that woman. What would be known about this one is probably, where's the impeachable offense? Why are we here?
The offenses of Trump, according to the Democrats' counsel, Barry Burke, are pretty straightforward.
He put his political reelection interests over the nation's national security and the integrity of its elections. He did it intentionally. He did it corruptly. He abused his powers in ways that the founders feared the most.
The first round of impeachment hearings was handled by the House Intelligence Committee, but it's the House Judiciary Committee that has to make impeachment happen. So today, committee members heard formal arguments for and against impeachment. They also listened to summaries of the evidence. Democrats argue that the facts were not in dispute. Republicans mostly attacked the process, but Minority Counsel Steve Castor went further.
The evidence does not support a conclusion that President Trump conditioned a meeting with President Zelensky on investigating former Vice President Biden.
Castor went on to argue that Trump was rightfully concerned about corruption in Ukraine. That's something we've heard a lot about through this impeachment process. But if you go to Ukraine and ask Ukrainians, they'll say it's not fair or accurate. But different types of corruption in Ukraine still persist. The World's Daniel Offman traveled to the capital of Kyiv to find out more.
Across the street from the Taras Shevchenko National University in Kyiv, there's a park where students hang out between classes. They chat, smoke cigarettes, and squeeze in some last-second studying. I'm here to ask people about an uncomfortable subject, corruption.
If you don't study, you can pay money and have a nice grade. And that's not a problem here.
Bribery is the problem, says Alexei Alexeyev. He's a law student here at the university.
Do you know people who basically get through university like this?
Yeah, of course. I know it. A lot of people.
And do they talk about it openly? Are they?
Yeah. It's not a taboo. It's not taboo.
Taboo is taboo.
Yeah, it's not taboo.
But hang on a minute, Alexei's friend Vlad Kachenko says. He's another law student. Vlad disagrees with Alexei. He says, we have a good country here, good people. Corruption actually isn't a huge deal. But Alexei chimes in again.
I don't have any hopes because study here is very bad. I want to go to USA, and this year I applied for a green card.
Alexei is pessimistic about the future of Ukraine, and corruption is a big reason why. But this isn't a new problem here. The fight against corruption came to a boiling point in Ukraine in 2014.
Hundreds of thousands of demonstrators gathered in the biggest show of strength yet, denouncing the government's decision not to sign a far-reaching trade deal with the European Union, favoring instead building closer ties with Moscow.
Ukrainians wanted to rid their country of corrupt Russian influence. And after months of protests and brute government violence, Viktor Yanukovych, Ukraine's corrupt pro-Russian president, fled the country. This is the place where many Ukrainians started learning about the full extent of Yanukovych's corruption. The banks of a reservoir inside his 350-acre estate. Here's investigative journalist Darina Shevchenko.
Journalists found a lot of documents.
The papers were just floating in the reservoir.
They took them out, dried them, and started studying them. And a lot of things we learned about Yanukovych from those documents, like that he would buy lamps for hundreds of thousands of dollars at the time when the country was like really poor.
After Yanukovych fled the country, his people tried and failed to get rid of evidence of his corrupt behavior. The documents discovered here in the aftermath of the revolution helped Ukrainians learn all about their former president's illegal activity.
There were crowds of people, like hundreds of people walking around, same lost faces, like, wow, what's happening? So everybody asking each other, like, where are we? What is that?
Ukrainians decided to turn the Yanukovych estate into a museum of corruption. This was a symbolic victory for Ukraine and a hopeful sign for a newly empowered anti-corruption movement. Another sign of hope came in 2018 with the election of a new president.
President Ukraine, Volodymyr Oleksandrovich Zelensky.
Volodymyr Zelensky, a former TV actor, won the presidency on an anti-corruption platform. The public knew him already from his hit TV show, Servant of the People. Zelensky played a high school teacher who becomes the president of Ukraine under unlikely circumstances. Sound familiar?
Значит так, закон один для всех. А иначе, пожалуйста, чемоданы в руки, большой привет.
Вы что, нам угрожаете?
In this scene, the fictional president Zelensky is challenging a corrupt tycoon. He says, there is one law for all. Otherwise, pack your bags and say goodbye. The scene captures the real President Zelensky's agenda quite well. With the majority in parliament, they're pushing an anti-corruption agenda. The message is clear. Even Ukraine's biggest tycoons, also known as oligarchs, need to take notice. But in real life, that's easier said than done. Darina Shevchenko says Ukraine's oligarchs are not going anywhere. Just look at how they control the news media and push their own agendas.
That makes the information space overwhelmed with the fakes and the disinformation. And that is a big problem for Ukraine because the majority of the population is still getting the information from the TV news.
Vadim Miskiy is an analyst at Detector Media, a nonprofit based in Kyiv. He says that in this country, the tycoons rule the airwaves.
All the hot political topics are connected with the position of this oligarch. If some speakers are commenting something, it means that it's connected with the position of the owner.
Vadim says most Ukrainians understand this and are able to navigate the news landscape accordingly.
Channel Ukraine, owned by oligarch Akhmetov, ICTV channel, owned by another oligarch Pinchuk, Inter channel is owned by the guy who is now arrested in Austria, Dmytro Firtash.
Some of the oligarchs in Ukraine are pro-Russian. Others want closer ties to the West. All of them are pro-big business and skeptical of government regulation. Miskiy says that even President Zelensky, the anti-corruption reformer, has ties to an oligarch named Igor Kolomoisky and his TV channel OnePlusOne.
Zelensky had his own production, which produced a few comic shows. These comic shows had exclusive contracts to showing on TV channel of Kolomoisky on OnePlusOne.
So the oligarch Kolomoisky is basically President Zelensky's former boss. Maybe it's no surprise, then, that OnePlusOne has treated Zelensky with overwhelmingly positive news coverage. That makes some Ukrainians uneasy. But Zelensky has tried to distance himself from Kolomoisky, saying that he's not a toy in the oligarch's hands. Investigative journalist Darina Shevchenko says Ukraine's corruption problem runs deep. It's not just about politicians and powerful oligarchs. It filters down to everyday life.
And that's a big problem, because then corruption becomes normal, and it's very hard to root it out. But rooting it out is not a question of a year or even 5 years. It's a question of generations.
Here's an example. When Ukrainians go see a doctor, they might also offer a gift. Darina calls it a bribe, and she's vehemently against it. She's even gotten into arguments about this with her mother.
We have fights. We our discussions sometimes have a dead end where my mom says, like, but you know, doctors, they're so poor. And I'm like, yeah, but that's not the problem you are going to solve, right? So you can only solve the problem of you giving bribes. That are bribes. Let's call them bribes because they're not thank you gifts or something else. They're bribes.
I asked Darina about what I heard from students at the university, giving bribes to teachers for good grades. She says it's all connected. Ukraine's hope for a less corrupt future, Darina says, must begin with education.
We should teach children that corruption is not okay on any level. Giving, you know, 100 hryvnias to a professor for a better mark is not okay. And then these children later will not vote for the corrupt officials because they will know that they have a right to better life and these people don't have a right to abuse their power.
In other words, day-to-day corruption normalizes a corrupt mentality. And those small sins just enable the big stuff, the kind of corruption committed by oligarchs and politicians, which is exactly what Ukrainians are trying to overcome. For The World, Daniel Hoffman, Kyiv, Ukraine.
For years, Aung San Suu Kyi was revered as a defender of human rights. She stood up to a brutal military government in Myanmar and paid a price, spending years under house arrest. Suu Kyi's advocacy helped her win a Nobel Peace Prize and later an election as a top government official. But tomorrow she will be at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, defending Myanmar's army against allegations of genocide. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports how things have changed for this one-time global icon of human rights.
In 1988, back when Myanmar was still officially called Burma, the country erupted. People were fed up with military rule. As Aung San Suu Kyi would later put it,
they were tired of living under dictatorship. They were tired of being poor. They were tired of being afraid.
These were the fires that forged Suu Kyi the icon. Her father was a founder of the nation. And when she joined the uprising in Yangon, the largest city in the country, the crowds adored her. It was like having the daughter of George Washington on their side. But the military rulers were not willing to give up power. People were shot in the streets, activists hunted down, especially college students. And many faced a choice: rot in jail, get killed, or flee. That's what Kin Omar did. She was a chemistry student turned protester, forced to escape into the jungle.
I told my mother that I'll be back home in 3 months. I had no idea how this is going to, where this is going to lead and how long this is going to take.
That's Kin Omar speaking nearly 10 years ago to the Bush Institute, as in George W. Bush. In the jungle, she hid out with a rebel group for a while and later made it all the way to the U.S., where she became one of the Free Burma campaign's top activists. The spiritual leader of the movement was Aung San Suu Kyi, who was put under house arrest by the military regime.
After all these years being imprisoned in one house alone by herself, it's a spirit that you just can't even imagine.
Kin Omar channeled that spirit to the outside world. And like many others, her devotion was intense. She would pray to Buddha with two photos in front of her, one of her mom, one of Suu Kyi, wishing them well-being and asking Suu Kyi for inner strength.
I drew the inner strength. I drew the strength from her. So she was the hope.
She was the hope. Was. Kin Omar was hesitant to speak to me about Suu Kyi because her whole adult life is intertwined with this icon. Kin Omar has testified in Congress, helped convince the U.S. to base its whole Myanmar policy around Aung San Suu Kyi and her promise to liberate the people of Myanmar. But she just can't do it anymore.
I mean, she broke my heart. My heart is so broken. My heart is really broken.
In recent years, Myanmar's army has stormed a coastal part of the country, the homeland of a Muslim group called the Rohingya, carrying out massacres and looting and rapes. Here are families sobbing as their homes are being torched. These atrocities, which are often supported by Buddhist nationalist groups, they were meant to purge the Rohingya out of the country, into neighboring Bangladesh, where they think the Muslims belong. This sounds like exactly the sort of tyranny that Suu Kyi has always stood against. This is a person who has received the highest praise from the most powerful world leaders, like Hillary Clinton.
Someone who has represented the struggle for freedom and democracy, for human rights and opportunity.
Okay, surely that person has to deplore what's happening to the Rohingya Muslims, right? But when she's asked about this purge of more than 500,000 people, here's how she responds.
I have said that I condemn human rights everywhere. And you must not forget that there have been human rights violations on both sides of the communal divide.
Both sides. Now, Suu Kyi does not control the army, which allows some of her foreign admirers to cling to this belief that, deep inside, she weeps for the Rohingya. But now we have Suu Kyi testifying at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, defending what really looks like genocide.
She's on the wrong side, obviously. She's on the wrong side of humanity. To me, this is the end.
This is the end, Khin Omar says. A while back, she went to her Buddha statue, to that photo of Suu Kyi, and said, it's over. She said, Suu Kyi, as I see it, you are no longer leading the struggle. You're just a politician. It was closure, she says, a clear departure from the disgraced icon.
So to me, it's a very clear departure. Painful. I cried a lot. I had quite a long moment of crying day and night, but I was able to do that.
Until now, Khin Omar hasn't really discussed this pain in public. Not like this. I've been self-censoring, she says. Because in Myanmar, you say anything bad about Suu Kyi and...
you will be hated. You will be scolded at. You will be discredited. Your space becomes small.
And her space has become smaller. Khin Omar runs an activist group called Progressive Voice. But because she's spoken out about the Rohingya and other minorities, her peers, the other former students who faced the regime in 1988, they've denounced her. She's even gotten death threats from ultra-nationalists in Myanmar. And she says she's been blacklisted from her home country. So now she's based right across the border in Thailand. Meanwhile, in Yangon, the city she once fled, there are these new pro-Suu Kyi rallies. We stand with Daw Aung San Suu Kyi. That's a Twitter video posted by Kate Diamond, a Myanmar journalist. Actually, Suu Kyi's image has improved from all this, at home at least, because to her supporters, Suu Kyi is standing up to foreign forces that slander the country with fake news. Khin Omar says, look, I get it. I know how they feel.
People love her and adore her and even worship her, literally.
Khin Omar is no longer a Suu Kyi disciple, but she still does pray, wishing good leadership upon Suu Kyi. Right now, though, she says, those wishes are not coming true. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
When those genocide hearings get underway in The Hague this week, the Rohingya art activist YY Nu will be in the courtroom. We'll speak with her tomorrow here on The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.